Europe's refugee crisis is no longer in the headlines, but thousands of migrants continue to arrive on its shores seeking a better.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. More than 70 million people are forcibly displaced worldwide. Among them are over 25 million refugees who have fled across international borders and are unable to return to their homes. The discussion about the solutions to the refugee crisis coming up right here on Straight Talk Africa. Joining me today are Elizabeth Lizama, Communications and Social Media Coordinator for the International Organization for Migration, INBO VOA reporter and co-host of VOA's Our Voices, and Lual Mayen, CEO of Junub Games, joining us from Geneva in Switzerland is VOA correspondent Lisa Bryan, and by phone from still Geneva, Eskinder Negash, President and CEO of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Migrants. I want to welcome all of you to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much for having us.
So Lisa, let me come to you in Geneva. What is the latest development regarding the conference?
Well, the talks have just wrapped up, and there were a number of pledges of a number of billions of dollars. The World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, businesses, individuals and states. And so, you know, there was some financial pledges. There were apparently a lot of in-kind pledges. So the UNHCR, which hosted the conference, said something like more than 770 pledges, anything from money to legal assistance as pro bono, jobs, job skills training. I mean, it's just been sort of a conglomerate of things. And I think the bigger thing is that this is the first ever of its kind, this kind of global refugee forum that also is bringing in refugees so that they can talk about their plight and also on the table in terms of solutions. So you would have to ask UNHCR, but it really was, it was perhaps a game changer for them.
So, Lisa, you've been speaking with some of these participants. What has been the feedback that you've gotten from some of these participants so far?
Well, I've spoken to a mix of participants, and the feedback has been sort of various. I spoke to refugees who say that they really should be at the table and make the decisions of issues that really concern them. I've talked to developing countries that are hosting refugees. For example, some of the delegates from Cameroon and also Ethiopia, and they really need more assistance from developed countries. I spoke to people who are working in terms of clean energy businesses and also members of the humanitarian community, and they are really trying to push clean energy in refugee camps, which is a very interesting interesting concept. So very different responses in terms of everybody is coming at this from a different point of view.
With the recent surge in refugees, do you sense, or is there a political will to handle this problem and address it pragmatically?
I think you need to ask experts for this, but I mean, I live in Paris in France, and the refugee crisis is ongoing. We've seen, thousands and millions of people trying to find better lives. Everybody says climate change is going to make it even more difficult. And governments, not all, but a number of governments are closing their doors. So I think it's going to take much more than one refugee conference to change mindsets of governments and also of people.
Before you leave us, Lisa, what do you make of the outcome of this conference? Is there a commitment to expedite the solution or implement the solution to resolve these concerns with the refugees?
I think that, having a this conference, a two-day conference that was in some ways 3 days, really is important to have people around the table to discuss the issues, all the people that are involved with it. But I think everybody would probably agree that these are very complex questions that demand long-term solutions. So I think the fact that people are together talking is really good, but I think that having a really fast answer is probably not realistic. But I think that, you know, the fact that there were so many pledges and that they were quite substantial, and that is obviously a step forward.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Let me come to you, Elizabeth. Today is International Migrants Day, and what would your organization focus on?
Sure. So as you mentioned, with the global picture of forced migration, we see that there are more than 70 million people who have been forcibly displaced, and unfortunately, there's not a simple solution. And sometimes resettlement might be the viable option. In other instances, we might be able to offer voluntary return to the country of origin. But as we continue to see these issues and conflict continue, and we have displaced persons in host communities, this year for International Migrants Day, we wanted to focus on integration and social cohesion, and really celebrating migrant stories, but also the host communities that are welcoming refugees and migrants around the world. So whether it be socioeconomic integration and creating livelihood opportunities, or even cultural integration and finding opportunities where communities can get together for whether it's the arts or music. So that is the focus of this year's International Migrants Day.
All right, let me go to Eskenda. Can you hear me, Eskenda?
Yes, I can.
Now, you are in Geneva. Give me your overview about the two-day conference.
Great. The first thing I can tell you is there were about 2,000 people came to this conference. I also noticed that a lot of head of states came to attend the meeting. And the gathering was kind of co-convened by a number of countries. Some of them are refugee hosting countries, like Costa Rica, Ethiopia, Pakistan, and Turkey. I mean, as you know, in Turkey, there are nearly, 4 million or more Syrian refugees. So it's a big gathering. And I think Lisa mentioned to you that a number of countries, private companies, governments have pledged millions of dollars. I worry that these pledges may be not binding pledges, even though some of them are pro bono pledges, but the cash pledge from different countries, millions of dollars, private corporation. It's something I had never seen before, and I've been coming to Geneva for a refugee meeting for many years, but this is quite different. And if the pledges are really materialized, I have a feeling that UNHCR will be in a different position to provide services. At the same time, as we speak about this refugees, 25 million refugees, you have also a very protracted refugee situation still with no solution. You have refugees in Sudan since 1968, and refugees in Kenya since 1991. You have refugees in Algeria since 1975. And you have refugees for over 30 years in Pakistan. These are a very protracted refugee situation, and I don't think any of the delegates or the head of state came up with a solution to solve this problem. In the meantime, as you know, the number of refugees are trying to go to up north is also increasing. It's not dying. And the number of refugees not getting asylum is also increasing. So it's a mixed feeling for me, even though it was major gathering and a lot of discussion on every aspect of the refugee life was discussed. But at the end of the day, are refugees going to be given the right to work, the right to go to school, the right to own business, the right to have education, all of these things remain the same.
Well, Negash, a lot of the times, yes, when there are conferences, there are pledges, and some commitments that are made. What is different this time around? Because some of these pledges sometimes do not get realized.
Well, you're right. These are pledges, and I don't know to what extent they are binding pledges means, the companies or governments will actually contribute. But the magnitude is different. I would say the pledges were close to, several billions of dollars, when you take also in kind contributions. It's remarkable. Again, that's not going to be solving the refugee situation. They're still warehoused in refugee camp for many, many years, as I mentioned. They have no future. They can still keep in the refugee camp for another decade or more. Nobody came up with a solution, what to do with them. But in the meantime, I guess the pledges and the amount of money given perhaps will give some refugees a chance to go to school, or start the business, a micro-enterprise business. So there is some hopeful discussion again. At the end of the day, one has to check whether this is happening or just simply a promise not delivered.
Eskinder Nagash is president and CEO of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants. We'll come to you again. IMBO, let me come to you. You've been reporting on refugee issues. Tell me about your experience in your reporting stories on that.
Well, if I can just say, the fact that you have two former South Sudanese refugees at the table, I think is emblematic of just how big the issue on the South Sudan side is. I am from South Sudan, and I was born during the Second Civil War. So because of that, I wasn't born in South Sudan. I was born next door in Ethiopia, and then I eventually grew up in Kenya. And we actually passed through Kakuma refugee camp in the early 90s on our way into Nairobi. Since then, I've become a journalist. Like many refugees, they hope to, get an education and get jobs and live their lives. I've been very fortunate enough to do that. But as we've heard so far, it's hard for a lot of refugees to do that. As a reporter, I have spoken to countless refugees, and I think that the situation is grim, if I'm being completely honest with you. You look at a camp like Kakuma. When Kakuma was made in the early 90s, it was a temporary solution. And now, I went back just there. I was there just a couple of months ago, and I spoke to people who had been there their entire lives, who met their wives there, who gave birth to their children there, and that it's become a permanent solution for them.
And Kakuma was supposed to be a temporary kind of solution, correct?
Right, yeah. I mean, it was, and most refugee camps are supposed to be temporary solutions. No one thinks that they are going to live their entire life in a refugee camp. That's unfathomable to the refugees and, I believe, to the international community. But the problem is, when we do speak to refugees, what they tell us is the reason that they left is because they had to, because In the case of South Sudan, it's because of conflict. Sometimes it's also because of the weather. There's drought, there's floods, and they have to leave their countries. But in the case of conflict, what we keep hearing from them is that the only solution that there is a political one. And so they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because they want their leaders to come to a political solution to stop the violence, but at the same time they feel completely powerless in countries that, aren't really theirs.
Luau, let me come to you. Mm. What has been your experience being a refugee? You've chalked some successes here in the U.S. Mm. What has been your experience?
First of all, as Ian mentioned before, as a refugee by myself, a lot of people have this idea that when you become a refugee or when you go to a refugee camp, it's a temporary place. But that is something we should really think about, a way of these refugees are always there. It's like a permanent home for them. For me, I've lived there for 22 years. And to me, I feel like there's only way we can be able to help the refugees, even where they are. But I'm not going to talk more about what the organization could do, but what exactly we need as refugees, because a lot of people think that we are a burden to the society, but we are not. All we want is opportunities, because these are people that have lost their hope. They have lost what they love. All they want is to start their life from zero, because there's nobody who can just wake up in the morning and leave what they love. So I feel for me, growing up in a refugee camp, it wasn't a choice for me, but it was something that I really want a second chance in life, where I can be able to live in a peaceful environment, where I can be able to live, where I wake up in the morning and I have something to eat, I have something to like survive. But like, I feel like the most important thing is like these refugees need resources, they need opportunities, they need education, because that can be able to help them restore their hope. And yeah.
Let me come to you, Elizabeth. Yeah. Talk to us about forced migration in the context of mixed flows.
Right. So Ian mentioned some individuals have been displaced by conflict, but also natural disasters. And so that is a growing trend that we are continuing to see. Specifically, individuals who haven't necessarily crossed an international border, and those we call internally displaced persons. And they also have different vulnerabilities and needs that we also need to take into consideration. But also, again, as I mentioned earlier, we have more than 70 million people who have been forcibly displaced. And so that includes the refugees and the asylum seekers and internally displaced persons. And so at IOM, one thing that we do is focusing on mixed flows. We need to cooperate with UNHCR and other agencies to make sure that we are meeting the needs and assisting governments to be able to meet some of those operational challenges continues to be at our focus.
Eskenda, let me come to you. You've been involved in refugee issues for a lot of years. What are some of the challenges that these refugees face and how they can surmount some of these challenges to be integrated into society?
Yeah, I think part of the challenge we have, this is the same challenge for the past 20, 30 years, is refugees don't get the rights that they deserve, you know, they're entitled to. Under the 1951 Convention, refugees are not supposed to be permanently live in a refugee camp. If FRI for the past 15 years has been advocating on behalf of refugees, and we use the term refugee warehousing, should stop immediately. Refugees need to get the right to have a business, the right to go to school, the right to have freedom like any human being. And, I appreciate all the gatherings that you are doing. I think the work of IOM is incredible. But at the end of the day, refugees don't seem to have a right. If you are living for 20, 30, 40 years in refugee camp, you know, then you are actually just warehoused for with no future for you or for your family. So I think that's part of the challenge we have. We need to come up with a political solution. Refugees have a well-founded fear of persecution to go back to their country. There should be a solution, including a resettlement is one durable solution. But local integration is another solution. I think part of the challenge, and someone mentioned refugee crisis, I think we don't really have a refugee crisis. I think we have a crisis of with the international community not taking your responsibility. We have a crisis of responsible responses to refugees. So this refugee crisis is an outcome of a protracted refugee sustain. People don't want to leave the refugee camp forever. And we have people for 50 years, 30, 40 years in refugee camp. So unless their right is enshrined, under the 1951 convention, a lot of the countries were signatories to that convention should actually honor what China. So I think that's part of the challenge we have. You know, we can't have this, this gathering again and again. People will be pledging. But at the end of the day, if it's not based on freedom for refugees and the right for refugees, all of these pledges or this commitment is not going to make a difference.
Thank you very much, Eskenda. Eskenda Negash is President and CEO of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants. Let me come to you, Lual. So what can other refugees learn from your experience?
Yeah, for me, when I, as a game designer and a refugee who became a game designer, and also as an African who is an independent game designer, like the most important thing to me is for the refugees to learn that we can be able to achieve anything even if the world has forgotten us. Because there's something I always describe, which is like human talent. That's something no matter they take what they love from us, no matter what, like we lost the people that we love in our life through the war and become refugees, there is that second chance in life we all want. We all have the capability and the mentality to be able to become, create what we love. And when I learned one day that I am passionate about making video game, and then, and because my mother, who was actually a refugee, believed in me when she wasn't a refugee. It wasn't like someone from, like from a well-developed country, or it wasn't somebody who was like from a rich family that actually saw what I can be able to do. It was a refugee like me who actually saw what I was doing and invested in me, bought my first computer in a refugee camp. There was nobody having it. And then, but because like, to me, like I realized that when I got my first computer and I have to work for 3 hours every day, it was nothing to me. It was nothing compared to my parents fleeing the country. So living in a refugee camp became like an opportunity for me to be able to see what is the best way I can be able to work my, make my way through and become who I am today. So I feel like the most important thing is that as refugees, we have the capability, and for them, we have the, you know, we can be able to achieve what we want. We can be able to work in one of the best tech companies in the world. We can be able like to just contribute to the society. You know, when people look at me today, they're like, were you a refugee? Yeah, I was, but they don't look at that. It's not my identity, right? But it's my root, it's where I come from. So I feel like as refugees, we can be able to like, you know, create our companies, you know, become entrepreneurs, employ people, and we are like contributing to the society. The only difference is that we have left what we love, which is our home. Mm. But like, yeah, but I feel like that's the most important issue.
Let me come
and,
to Aya.
Yeah, right. And to that point, I just wanted to add, just last month, I spoke to a former lost boy of then Sudan who won a city council seat in Syracuse, New York. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to him, he actually told me that, because he went through Kakuma as well, and he told me that when he came to New York, in the city of Syracuse, he realized that the conditions there were very similar to the refugee camp that he had left. Mm-hmm. And he thought, how could this be, that this is a first world country, the United States is? Why is there high crime rates? Why is there so much poverty? And he decided almost 20 years ago that he would do something about it. So 20 years later, he was elected to city council, and he told me that one of the things that he wants to do is fix those issues. And I actually didn't notice prior to speaking to him, but Syracuse is one of the poorest cities in the United States. It makes the top 10 list every census. So I think that the perspective that he is bringing is one that Americans don't have. You know, to go from a refugee camp and then to be elected to city council, and to use that as a way to kind of change the policies in the U.S. That are fairer and better for people, I think it will be really fascinating to watch. Mm.
Talk to me about some of your reporting. Recently you went to Kakuma, you spoke to teachers. Talk to me about the education system. Is that enough to well equip some of these refugees to be better, to challenge the status quo, or to better equip themselves for the future?
Well, the students that I spoke to, and I spoke to a lot of students, they are just as ambitious as any teenagers in the entire world. I spoke to a young woman who just casually said that she wants to be president of the Democratic Republic of Congo one day, because that's where she's from. Mm-hmm. And she really believes that she can indeed do that. I think that, you know, even though the refugees in Kakuma are restricted because they have to get special permission to travel around the country, they obviously they're allowed to, you know, live and walk around Kakuma, but in order to leave Kakuma, they have to get special permission. So even though that restriction is there, mentally it's not there for a lot of the young people that I spoke to. But I spoke to a lot of teachers who told me that on average, they teach about 100 students each class, each day, and that has become the norm for them. And of course, they don't have enough resources. They don't have the technology. They don't have, you know, lights. You know, if it gets dark, when the students go home, they don't have lights, you know, in their houses to do their homework. So there's a lot of issues, but I think even within those issues, there's a lot of determination within both the teachers and the students to make something of themselves, so that, you know, one day that they can overcome the refugee title that, you know, that they've inherited or that they have.
Elizabeth, what are the drivers behind migration? and what are some of the challenges associated with some of these issues of migration?
Yeah. So again, we see people compelled to leave for various reasons, conflict being one of them, and we spoke a little bit about natural disasters. But other times, you know, migration isn't necessarily a negative reason that people leave. Some people are leaving to find educational opportunities. In other cases, people might be looking to reunify with family, or in other instances, people leave because there is a lack of access to basic needs, whether it's education or health services, or they find that they're being discriminated against and lack human rights, basic human rights. So there are many different drivers that we are seeing. And so it's important, again, to be able to contextualize those different situations, because every migrant and refugee's needs are different. And so in terms of challenges, one of the primary challenges, of course, is the vulnerabilities of migrants and being able to ensure that we uphold their human rights. That is critical. But also in the host communities, in certain situations like we see in Latin America right now, where we have an influx of refugees and migrants from Venezuela, that places a strain on countries that don't typically see these numbers. So it can often be a challenge in that sense. But also, I think it marks an opportunity as well. I think Luol's story is really inspiring, and it's a testament on how the diaspora can also contribute to solutions. So whether it's sending remittances. So we know that more than $500 billion in remittances last year. That is an incredible opportunity to have diaspora organizations being able to contribute to their countries of origin and contribute to development in those countries. So I see it as an opportunity as well.
But in some instances, refugees complain that in the societies or countries that they go to, there's a suspicion of them taking advantage of the system, they take jobs away from the indigenes and all that. How do you address some of these concerns?
Right, and I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there, and so it is so important to be able to partner with different organizations, with academic institutions, to be able to kind of debunk a lot of those misconceptions. And the media, of course, is a very important partner to ensure that the debate around migration is based on evidence and based on facts. And so I think that is something that we need to continue to raise awareness around issues concerning migration.
And in your reporting, did some of these issues come up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just going to say, I think it's also important to include host communities in those conversations. Uganda is a really good example. Somebody brought up local integration as a potential solution just a little while ago. Uganda has basically taken that model, and they welcome in refugees into their country. Refugees are allowed to work. They're allowed to go to school. In some cases, they're even given a plot of land. The problem is that has created tension between the refugee communities and the local communities. I think that, you know, whether it be officials in the government or officials in the UN, you know, that's an issue that really needs to be looked at closely. Just last week, we reported on a refugee incident in northern Uganda where at least four people died after there was a disagreement, and there was a big fight that erupted afterwards. And so, you know, when we talk about what are some of the issues are actually life-threatening, because when you think of the host community and they're watching refugees get all the assistance from the UN, they're also thinking, well, I'm also in need. Why am I not getting that help? And so I think that really needs to be talked about. Mm.
Luol, did you experience some of these issues they are talking about, and how did you surmount it? And now that you are successful, do you reach back to some of the people you had known to help them out?
Yeah, for sure. Like as someone who has lived that life, you know, it's and to where I am today, I would better talk about, you know, what I'm doing than like because there's so much happening. These are reality, you know, from the local community, and they feel like, hey, you're coming to take our job. You are like taking the plot of land and all those stuff happening. But to me, like, since I started my company and like now living in the US, and also like working too hard. Like, the most important thing is now to give back to the refugees and also, like, represent. And that's why my game, Salam, you know, it's a game that actually put a shoes of a player in the refugee for them to understand what is the journey. Because a lot of people right now in the world, they have no idea of the journey of what refugees have been through. For them, it's just, oh, they're just refugees. But, like, when they play the game, they really understand what it has taken the refugees, like, to be where they are today. And from there, it helped them to learn about empathy and also helped them to learn maybe if someone in the U.S. kids, like, play the game, and in the next 10 years they're going to be in a place of making decision. But because they play the game, then they understand really what it took a refugee to become who they are. And then from there, they can be able to make refugees that are actually, they can be able to make, like, policy that can be able to favor refugees because they really understand what it means about the journey of a refugee. And that's, like, the most important thing, like, I'm really working on, to be able to see, like, I made this game that can really represent refugees and also, like, make people in the world be able to really get into, like, the whole idea of, like, refugees is not a burden. It's something you can be part of. It's something that you can be able, like, because game are so powerful, game can be able to, like, help people make decisions. And that's something I'm really so excited. I just premiered my game about at the Game Award, and I was really so excited because to be able to see the whole game industry recognize the work that I'm doing, and also, like, to become, like, the first African to, like, represent a game at the Game Award, and that's something, like, really gave me so much hope that the society and some few people are able to understand the work and think that refugees can be able to do, yeah.
So how has been the feedback regarding the game, and what impact do you see having on the lives of refugees?
There's been so much impact. There's been so much feedback from people, especially from the game community, because we are a community that is defined by people that love what to play. And we've been, like, having, like, beta testing the game. And one of the most important things right now we work on the game is that we have in-app purchases. It's a free-to-play game that is coming on Instant Game. So if someone in the game, like, buy food in the game to be able to, like, give the energy to the character who is actually running, you're actually buying someone in a refugee camp food. If you buy water in the game, you're buying water for someone in the refugee camp. If your character is hard and you need your character to be, you know, be held in the game, you're buying medicine for someone in a refugee camp. And to see that, I feel like we can take small steps to be able to change the environment, to be able to change the world. We don't need, like, you know, to me, like, that's the only way I can be able to give back to my community and where I come from. So, and the game industry is amazing. Instant Game has over 700 million players. And look, people, like, play my game. So it is something really, I'm really excited to be able to, like, be here today and be able to, like, use my experience as a play. Mm. Yeah.
Any input from you, Ian, with your reporting?
Well, with my reporting, I just want to say that the issue of refugees has become so politicized.
Yeah.
And I think that as reporters, we come at it from that angle because we talk to officials, we talk to refugees who, you know, really focus on the political side of it. But it is nice to talk to Lual Mayen and to do a story on Lual Mayen to talk about, you know, this part, the gaming side of it and what refugees can contribute back. And I think that a lot of people resonate with the story, you know, because who doesn't like to play video games or who doesn't like to have fun, but to use that in a way that helps people learn about the, you know, migration issues or refugee issues, I think is fascinating.
Well, Elizabeth, what are some of the possible solutions to resolve migration issues? Because now you've seen a surge in migration. A lot of Africans and other nationalities are moving to places where they think they can find opportunities to better their lives, to improve their living conditions. So what are some of the challenges? Because there are some suspicions, there are other challenges in host countries where these individuals, you know, reside and face.
Right. So when we talk about solutions, we can take a look at two different aspects here. First, again, what compelled those migrants and refugees to leave in the first place? So what types of programs and policies can ensure that people feel empowered to stay within their communities and that they don't have, you know, that they aren't left without a choice to migrate. So that is important, making sure that there are programs and access to basic services in those countries. But in terms of forced migration as a whole and addressing the current situation, there's a number of different durable solutions we can discuss. And I wanted to talk a little bit about refugee resettlement. And so we know that only a fraction of the world's refugees are able to be resettled to a third country. So we need to explore other pathways, whether it be humanitarian visas or family reunification or labor migration programs that will help not only migrants and refugees, but it will help those communities to meet a certain labor demand in their country. But in those cases when resettlement isn't an option, but the conditions in their country of origin are conducive to voluntary return, that is the most preferred solution. But unfortunately, we don't see that because the protracted crisis isn't necessarily conducive to have migrants and refugees be able to voluntarily return, and that could potentially jeopardize their safety. So kind of taking it back to the theme of International Migrants Day this year, a focus on integration and social cohesion, I think that there's not enough attention on that area, and I think that that is an area where we need to take a look at how we can best support. And that is important to involve everyone. So governments, NGOs, humanitarian actors, development actors, and the diaspora, I think that there's a role for everyone to play in different solutions and so in social cohesion and integration, I think is another area that
religious
need
groups
to
as well.
Of course.
All right. Well, you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment. We appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can catch our show here and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nana Kunedu Ajeman-Rawlings, the former First Lady of Ghana, reflects on the importance of empowering others and using public office to serve Ghanaian citizens. An in-depth discussion with Nana Kunedu Ajeman-Rawlings on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing the global refugee crisis. Our guests include Elizabeth Lizama from the International Migration, and then Ayen Biovio, reporter and co-host of Our Voices, Lual Mayen, CEO of Junub Games, Eskinder Negash, President and CEO of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Migrants. He had left. But let me come to you, Ayen. You wanted to ask something before we went on a short break?
Oh, no, I'm good. I'll let you ask the question.
All right, now let me come to you, Elizabeth. What are some of the best practices to promote acceptance of diversity and facilitate inclusion of migrants?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of different examples. And you know, on one end, we can look at best practices in socioeconomic integration. So creating jobs and empowering migrants and refugees to be able to start their own businesses. Because in turn, becoming entrepreneurs, they're going to hire people from the local communities and be able to contribute to their host communities. But also being able to offer training and support assistance so that migrants and refugees have the proper tools to meet those labor demands and access the labor markets in their host communities. But also there's opportunities for cultural and social integration, and so that could be in terms of using the art. So one example in Niger, we have different migrants, refugees, host community members engaging in street mural projects. And so another example in another country where we have migrants, refugees, and host community members in musical programs. So there's a lot of different examples also in education and making sure that students, that children have access to education and that they're being able to integrate. And so we see a lot of different examples and best practices around the world.
Ian, you initially spoke about you being a refugee. Mm-hmm. How was it like for you?
Well, it was not good. I think for me and my family, my mom especially, it was very hard on her because my dad was not with us. He was part of the SPLA, so he was fighting the war. And so she walked with us all the way into Ethiopia to give birth to me. And then while she was there, she then had to raise kids all on her own. And, you know, this was a time, this was in the late 80s. So when she gave birth to me, she didn't have really any proper medical doctors around her. So there was that issue. And then once she gave birth to me, she was constantly worried about losing me. My mom has lost 4 kids. You know, all of them passed away before the age of 2. And so that's the grim reality, I think, for a lot of refugee parents around the world is, you know, just hoping that they can raise their children into adulthood. And before you even think about that, or after you think about that, you know, then you have to worry about feeding them. You have to worry about, you know, will they get proper education? If they do get proper education, will they get jobs? I think there's a constant worry among refugees. And when one need is filled, then the next worry begins. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, I think we were like any other refugee family out there. You know, we really just had to hope that something would happen. And eventually something did. But of course, that's not the same for millions of people out there.
Mm. Luol, what was your journey like? I mean, you said somebody bought you a computer, but how did you become a refugee? Take me through the process.
Yeah, it's like the same with most of South Sudanese. You know, because of the war that began in South Sudan, my family has to flee the war. And during the war, I was actually not born. I was born on the way. If you look actually at my game, like it's the same place that I was born in Amer. It's set in the game, like in a mountainous place. And I was born, and then from there we went to northern Uganda. It wasn't easy for a child who was born on the way to be able even to survive. Nobody knew that I was going to survive because like there's no food, there's no even milk that I can be able to like have as a child. But like growing up in a refugee camp, it wasn't like an easy journey because you need education, you need inspiration because even like most of the people live in a refugee camp, they have like no inspiration because all they need is to be able to survive. But like during that moment, I was so creative. I really wanted something for myself, also for my family, to be able to like, with my mother has been so helpful to me to be able to like look at the importance of education and also like be able to understand that all I need is to be able to make myself a better person. And when I saw my computer the first time during a refugee registration, that moment actually helped me to understand that, hey, I want to use a computer one day, and I don't care whatever is going to take me to be able to use a computer. And from there, it's like I just trained myself. I used like online tutorials. Like there was no internet in a refugee camp. There was nobody to be able to teach me how to code. But for me, like I was like, if my mother can be able to work hard and buy for me a computer in a refugee camp, it changed everything for me. That for me, I can be able to do it. So I started like learning myself, training myself how to code. One day, someone installed for me a video game on my computer, Grand Theft Auto, and then I started playing it, and was like, wow, you know, I never thought video games are made by people because I was living at a place where you actually, I knew nothing about video game. Even when I had the inspiration to be able to create games, all I wanted was to be able to create something, not for the world or not for people in the game industry to play. I really wanted to create something for refugees that they can be able to play something, they can be able to like come together and play. And from there, like, it was more than just vision. It was more than, because what I created was what people want in the world. And then from there, I remember like in a refugee camp, there was no internet. I can be able to distribute the game. The game was less than 10 MBs. So I used Bluetooth to be able to send the game, which was like the most craziest thing somebody has ever done in the video game industry. But all I wanted like refugees to have something to be able to play. My focus was, you know, I want to make them happy. I want to make them play a game. And then from there, like, I am here, like, I'm creating the game for the world. I have a company that we can be able to, like, make game for impact. And right now, my game is coming out, and I see, like, the industry, like, supporting what I'm doing. So it's possible, yeah.
And Peter, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You should note that it took his mom 3 years to save up $300 to buy Lual his first computer. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about possible solutions, I think that job creation is really important, because even in a progressive place like Uganda, or at least progressive towards refugees, in a progressive place like Uganda, it still took his mom years to raise that amount of money. So you can imagine how hard it is to make a living even in a place like Uganda.
Mm. You know, people have talked about solutions to resolving this migrant and refugee crisis. They've mentioned the Ugandan model. Some say the Ethiopian model could be effective in some areas. In your reporting, what have you seen?
Well, so Uganda and Ethiopia are, I think, really good examples. As you just said, we talked about Uganda just a little while ago. Ethiopia is trying to integrate refugees into their societies as well. But then we see other countries like Kenya, who they've threatened to close down camps. You know, every so often they threaten to close down Dadaab refugee camp. Their officials have said that they don't want refugee camps in the country for various reasons. So I think even within the region, there's a diversity in how officials take on this issue. And that's been really fascinating for me to watch. But like I said, you know, Kakuma, this is a place that has become a permanent solution for a lot of its residents, the same with Dadaab. So if you do close down those camps, then where do these hundreds of thousands of people go? And so these are the questions that the officials really need to answer, because the officials who don't want there to be refugee camps in their country, where will refugees go?
Elizabeth, I understand IOM faces some of these challenges. Migrants are expelled. Some countries don't even want to accept them because of various reasons that they pose. How do you resolve some of these concerns?
Right. And so that is a very complex situation, and it's very it depends on different situations. And so I think that in one area, say in Bangladesh or Libya or in Latin America, it requires a different approach specific to the needs. Having the migrants and refugees at the core of the response is important. But also, again, thinking through a multi-stakeholder approach and a whole of society where everyone plays a role in being able to address these issues is super important, between governments, between international organizations. No one country is going to be able to address this issue alone. And so it is important to make sure that we are being able to foster these partnerships to find durable solutions.
Mm. Yeah, and the very nature of refugees demands that at least multiple countries, you know, take a stab at the issue.
Mm. Elizabeth, one of the solutions that I have heard people talk about is opening up safe routes to sanctuary. Sanctuary for refugees is one important aspect that they talked about for both refugees and immigrants. What is your organization doing about this in terms of convincing host governments to ensure safe passage for these refugees? Because sometimes some of these refugees are caught up, you know, at the crossfires with the opposing sides.
Right, and that is a very important issue that we continue to work on, because the vulnerabilities that migrants and refugees face when they decide to take irregular routes. We see smuggling and trafficking, and so that is a major concern. So working with governments to be able to find different types of programs that are, that work for those countries, and again, it depends on the situation. So whether it's being able to find a solution and find whether it be humanitarian visas or other types of programs that can offer some type of solution, and that we again are able to promote safe and orderly migration so that migrants and refugees aren't forced to take these irregular channels.
And people have also talked about resettling, and you've seen your reporting people have been, you know, resettled and all that. But what about the issue of trafficking? Because some individuals take advantage of refugees and traffic them.
Yeah, that's a really big issue, I think. And I think that human trafficking, it preys on vulnerable individuals. A lot of them are, of course, asylum seekers or refugees trying to escape violence. And I think that this is an issue that is not talked about enough. This is an issue that, quite frankly, is underreported because it's really hard to report on human trafficking. It is a hidden crime. And I think that more reporting is needed to at least warn refugees or asylum seekers of what is ahead of them, because there are people in their journey who are there to simply take advantage of them. But I think that you make a valid point, because no one really talks about this. But we have heard from women who know that along the way that there might be, you know, men who will try to exploit them. We've heard from women who carry condoms with them because they know that they might get raped along the way. So I think that just more information towards victims, more information towards refugees and asylum seekers, just so they know some of the potential dangers along the way could help. But at the same time, I think that officials within the countries also need to do a lot more to catch perpetrators before they do get to the vulnerable communities.
Mm. Some people have also talked about the issue of trafficking with the undertones of racism. Before I come to you to talk about it, I saw you shaking your head. Loa, What did you want to say?
No, I'm good.
All right. Now, so let's talk about trafficking with the undertones of racism, and that some of these host governments will need to address some of these concerns, because although it's not on the surface, it happens quite often for both migrants and refugees. How do you resolve them as a leading organization handling immigration and migration?
Yeah, that is one area that we focus a lot on. As Ian mentioned, being able to prosecute those traffickers. So we assist governments in being able to, one, be able to identify situations of trafficking, and that can be a very difficult task to do. So we do assist governments in being able to bolster their local authorities, being able to identify and prosecute traffickers. But also providing assistance to those who have been trafficked. One other area that I wanted to discuss, and I think Ian brought a really interesting point, and it kind of speaks to the tragic situation that some individuals are in, that they would choose to continue despite knowing the vulnerabilities that a woman might be raped along the way. Given that, we do work a lot with migrants in different areas. In particular, we had a very successful program in West Africa where we had migrants be able to share their stories and tell their communities, these are the risks. And so we've seen some successes out of that program. And of course, when people feel like they have no other choice to migrate, they're going to continue despite knowing the risk. But that is also another important area that we try to raise awareness through different means, and being able to amplify those stories of other migrants who have experienced this journey and experienced the exploitation, have been trafficked. That is another important area.
NGOs, yeah. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to add about like what Ian mentioned about resettlement, because I think with my personal experience, first of all, with most of the organizations that are really responsible for resettlement, there should be like a clarity between the refugees and also like the time period of how long are they going to wait for them to be resettled, because this is something like refugees have no idea, and that's where they're like, they get tired of waiting. But if they really understand, like for my family, we have been, we tried to resettle for more than 20 years, and we have been rejected for like 10 years to like resettle with no reason. So I think that when it comes to like the resettlement, it's something like most of the refugees like are excited about, but it's also like something like there should be like a clarity and say, hey, this is a time period, or like this is what is happening, so that they really understand. And then from there, they know exactly who are like organizations that are responsible for doing something like this. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Some governments, I understand, blame refugees for the economic and social problems they have back home. Mm. How do you deal with it, Elizabeth?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of different factors, but again, I think the importance is focusing on the facts and what the evidence suggests. And so being able to have these frank conversations, I think, is also important. But I think, again, it's kind of different situations call for different responses, but I think more conversation is obviously necessary to be able to address some of the solutions that might actually have some merit.
Mm. Ian, in your reporting, did you see this? Because one of the solutions that has been proposed so far is that government should stop blaming refugees for some of the problems they have back home.
Well, I think part of the problem is that it has become very politicized, and so you have politicians who use refugees as a talking point to, you know, either speak to their constituents either one way or the other. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the facts are there, and the facts speak to themselves, really. And when you look at a country like South Sudan, where we're both from, you know, I think it'd be pretty hard to look at a refugee and say it's your fault that Salva Kiir and Riek Machar are fighting. Or I think it'd be hard to look at a refugee and say, you know, there was a cyclone in your village, and now your home is completely wiped out and you have no more living. That must be your fault as well. And so I'm not sure who is blaming refugees, but I'm not surprised to hear that there is some blame on refugees, because it is such a highly political issue. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we're going to stop hearing from these talking points from politicians, especially with election seasons coming up. But again, to your point, we're just going to have to really listen to the facts and know what the facts are, and, you know, use them in our reporting.
Elizabeth, before we go, does the IOM see asylum as a human right? And do you talk to government of migrants who want to resettle in their countries, or refugees who want to settle in their countries, to look at it from that perspective?
Right. So in terms of asylum, you know, one thing is national governments have the sovereignty to manage migration and to set policies for their own governments. But it is important that when doing so, that they respect international law and uphold their obligations.
Well, before we go, Ian, briefly, what are some of the prospects that you see, hope, of some of these refugees that you interacted with?
Well, for the case of South Sudan, we've heard from aid agencies that a lot of South Sudanese are indeed going back to their homes. Largely, that's because of a ceasefire that was agreed upon last year, which has been the longest holding ceasefire in South Sudan's history since the conflict began. And so that is good news, but still there are a lot of refugees and IDPs who are not returning home. So I think right now it's kind of a mixed bag. We see both conditions kind of happening simultaneously, but I think, you know, returning back home is a very personal choice. And no one can make a refugee return back home unless they want to. Mm-hmm. So I think, and you know, with the case of South Sudan, it's still a tumultuous situation. We have no idea what's going to happen come February. So it's wait to, we'll wait.
We'll see what happens.
Right, yeah.
On that note, our guests today were Elizabeth Lizama, Ian Bior, Lual Mayen, Lisa Bryan, and Eskinda Negash. Thanks to our audience for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa, and have a great evening.